commend you not only for braving the weather, which I guess today's a little better. Yesterday was more like a monsoon. But also for getting the time change right. I was just getting used to waking up in the morning and actually have the sun be out. So waking up this morning to total darkness was a little bit much to take. But I guess we'll get it on the back end because staying up late and having it be light is nice. One person did say to me this morning that she was watching the weather last night, and the weatherman said, well, at least with the time change, we'll have 1 hour less of this terrible weather. So that's a little bit of an encouragement right there to take home with us. Anyway, today we are looking at what is probably, along with the parable of the Good Samaritan, I guess, one of the most famous and most radical and most wonderful of all of Jesus' parables. So what can we say about this story this morning? And I thought the way that I would start off was just by putting it in context a little bit, because I've said this before, familiarity often breeds unfamiliarity. I don't know for how, some of you who have heard this story before maybe saw the story and you're like, oh, well, for the next 5 minutes I can check out because I know the story so well already that there's really no reason to listen to it again. But just to inject a little bit of some of the culture of the time into this particular story, because it's a crazy, bizarre, strange story. So we have this man with two sons, and the first thing that is radical and surprising is that the second son comes up to his father and basically says to his dad, "You are worth more to me dead than you are alive. You are worth more to me dead than you are alive. So why don't you give me what's mine, give me what's coming to me now, and let me take it because, I can do better with your money than you can. And I can do better if I take the share of property and go off and live my own life according to my own rules, doing what I want to do." And the second thing that's amazing is that the father actually does it. That there's no argument. He doesn't say, what are you thinking? Or are you really sure that's the best thing for you? But he freely gives him the money and says, doesn't actually say anything, just gives him the money and the younger son takes off. And I was reading a little bit about this in some commentaries this weekend, and it did say that actually if you look in the law, there was a provision made for sons sometimes collecting their inheritance before the death of their father, but usually it came with strings attached. Usually it was, okay, I'll give you this money, but any decisions that you make with this money, you need to consult me about those decisions, because this money still belongs to me. Even though I'm giving it to you, it's still technically mine until I die. And so there are some obligations that you're going to have with me, some strings attached with this money. But that's not, again, not what the father says. He gives him the money, no strings attached, and the boy goes off, and who knows what his motivation is, but he goes off to live his own life, and very quickly the money is gone. We find out a little bit from the older son what he's, what dissolute living actually means, what loose living actually means. But, imagine that suddenly, your father gave you, it probably was like a third of the estate, because the firstborn would have gotten a double portion according to the Old Testament law. So if you, think the older son gets twice as much as the younger son, that leaves a third for him. So imagine that you got sort of a third of your parents' estate and you went off and you lived the good life. In the beautiful San Fernando Valley. I don't exactly know where he went. But he probably gambled it away. He probably bought a lot of stuff. We find out that he spent some time with women of the night. And suddenly he finds himself in a really miserable situation. And Jesus makes it clear just how miserable the situation is. When he says not only is he living in a foreign country, not only is he living amongst, Gentiles, because this is probably a Jewish kid. Not only is he tending to pigs, which Gentile pigs, which if you're a Jew is just not something you want to be doing, but he longs to fill his stomach with the food that the pigs are eating. Has anyone ever fed pigs here? My mother-in-law actually has a ranch out in California and raises pigs. And the slop bucket is not a nice place. It's where all the leftover food from all the meals goes. And it's just this, it looks like this brown, sticky, gooey, chunky stew. Pigs will eat just about anything. Just about anything. And this man is longing to eat the slop that the pigs get. And so he comes to his senses, and we don't really find out whether this is an emotional decision or kind of a rational decision, whether it's coming from his heart or whether it's coming from his head, but he suddenly wakes up and says, what am I doing here? The men who serve my father in his house have plenty of bread to eat. They've got a warm place to stay. They have a master who cares for them and looks after them. I'm going to go home, and I'm going to beg my father to take me back. And that's what he does. He goes home, and he says, Father, I have sinned against you, and I've sinned against God, and I've wasted your money, and I've caused injury to your household, and I have no business being called your son anymore. Which actually is legally 100% true. This father has given this son all that he could ever possibly deserve and more, and the son has completely squandered it. And yet he comes back, and we also hear this amazing thing that the father, you know, while the son was a long way off, sees him and he runs to him. So there's this sense that, you know, not only is the father ready to accept him back, but he's actually looking for him. He's actually maybe sitting on I imagine this house on a hill or something with a porch, and him just looking out down the road, waiting, hoping, praying, dreaming that his son might return. And his son comes up and gives him his little spiel, and the father throws a robe on him and puts a ring on his finger and slaughters the fattened calf and throws him a huge party. And I guess what this makes me think of is oftentimes we can get some Christian concepts confused. And two concepts that we often conflate are mercy and grace. Someone said, what is the difference between mercy and grace? And the difference is that mercy is when you don't get what you deserve. Grace is when you get the opposite of what you deserve. Mercy in this situation would have looked like the father saying, all is forgiven, come and live with me, we'll sort of make a place for you, we'll clear a cot, you know, I'll give you a job, I'll take care of you, you know, all is forgiven. But grace is him lavishing on this son, giving him the opposite of what he deserves, treating this son as if he has done everything well and perfect and honorably. One of my students when I was doing youth ministry said that, you know, grace is like, you know, someone punching you in the face and you baking them a pie or something like that. You know, something that's so over the top, so counter to everything that you deserve that it makes no earthly sense. So then we have the older son, the dutiful son, the good son, the son who's trying to really earn his father's love. And he hears this party going on and he comes and he says, what is going on here? And remember, the son, the second son, has not just caused injury to his father, but he's caused injury to his entire family. I mean, who knows what kind of, how much they had to cut back as a result of losing a third of their money. That this is not just something that's affected the father, it's also something that's affected the older son, it's affected the rest of the family. Maybe he had to sort of let go a few of his hired help. Maybe people have actually lost their jobs as a result of the younger son's selfishness and self-centeredness. And so, of course, you know, we have we resonate deeply with a sense of injustice and unfairness that this older son has. Here I am doing everything right, and you've never given me anything. And you've given this son everything. And the father says, son, I love you, and all that I have is yours. But this son who's lost has been found, and we have to throw a party. We have to celebrate, because what has been lost has now been found. So what does this story have to say to us? Well, I want to talk about it in two parts, because here at St. Paul's, we often talk about, you know, what does this story tell us about who we are, and what does it tell us about who God is? And then thirdly, what does it have to tell us about the unique Christian message, the unique Christian perspective on the relationship between men and God? And the first thing I want to say about us is that all of us want to be happy, don't we? Don't you want to be happy? Don't you want to have kind of a good life? Don't you want to feel freedom and peace and joy? We all want happiness. But what we see in the story are two very different strategies to get that happiness. We see one strategy that's based on sort of, I'm going to do whatever I want to do, no matter how bad it is. I'm going to live my own life. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to rebel against my father. I'm going to leave it all behind and go, I'm just going to leave and do whatever I want to do. We sort of see a reactionary, bad approach to finding happiness. That the way I'm going to find happiness is by doing all those bad things that I wished I always could. You know, sort of a Las Vegas, you know, approach to happiness. That's one approach. And the other approach we see is the good, dutiful, disciplined. I'm going to follow the rules. I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to do everything I possibly can to earn the respect and the love and the pleasure of my Father. So we see sort of good and bad, rebellion and acquiescence, earning and sort of self-actualization. That we see these two brothers approaching these two different paths towards the same end. All they want to do is be happy, but they're taking two different paths towards it. And of course, the reason that the story resonates so much with us is because it really is our story. I mean, how many of you have families where there's, you know, sort of the good kid and the bad kid? You know, the dutiful child and the rebel. You know, the kid who stays home to take care of mom and dad and be there and do everything right versus the kid who just bails and does their own thing. I was watching Up in the Air last night, the George Clooney movie. George Clooney is definitely the bail, go do his own thing. He decides that, you know, having any relationships with basically anyone, most especially his family, is just too painful, and he wants to go and live life on his own terms. So let's talk about that first approach to life. It's very attractive, isn't it? Imagine if you had a, I mean, who here fantasizes about winning the lottery? Of course, I mean, you can't help, I mean, you walk by the, you know, the little newsstand, and you see, you know, Powerball is $200 million. That sounds amazing. Of course, after taxes and the lump sum, it's only about 60, maybe 70 million. But I could live with that probably. Of course, we fantasize about having money to do whatever we want with it. And at the same time, there's a part of us that is in rebellion, usually from where we came from. You know, I remember talking to a friend of mine who is coming to terms with the fact that most of his life was lived in rebellion against his father, that most of the choices he was making were in reaction against his father. And he was also coming to realize that that really wasn't the best thing for him, that as long as he was trying to run away from the decisions his father had made, that he was going to be defined by the mistakes that his father had made. And usually what happens when we're living in reaction and we sort of take it, I'm going to do whatever I want to do and live life on my terms, is that it leads to sin. It leads to pain. You know, that we hear, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but that's not actually true. It's not actually true. What happens in Vegas you bring home and you try to stuff and you try to hide, but it comes out in all sorts of different ways. And this approach to life does not work out. You know, it really pursued, it usually leads to something like a bottoming out. You know, when you try to live your life on your own terms and just rebel, sort of throw it all away, you experience very much what happened to this man. You find yourself in the midst of a situation doing something where you say, you know, I never thought that I was capable of doing something like this. It seemed like a good idea at the time. It felt right when I did it. And yet I'm finding that the consequences are shame and guilt and hiding and separation. That approach to happiness just doesn't seem to pay out the way that we want it to pay out. So then, of course, the other approach to being good is, or sort of finding happiness, I should say, the other approach to finding happiness is to do everything perfectly right, is to follow all the rules, is to get the good grades, is to work hard, is to obey your parents, is to get the right job, woke to do everything you can right in the hope that that will lead to happiness. You know, that was the approach that I'm a dutiful first child. I am. I've had my younger brother moments, don't get me wrong. But I was the dutiful first child. And where that gets shipwrecked on the realities of life is when we find out that the world isn't fair. That as hard as we're working, as much as we're trying to do everything right, that oftentimes things just don't work out the way we want them to work out. That life isn't fair, that we look at other people. You know, think about this older brother seeing his younger son. That we see people who don't deserve to get anything good or have anything good happen to them, and it happens to them. You know, people we work with, who we find to be the most unethical, you know, miserable bosses, and yet they're getting, you know, fabulously wealthy, or they're getting promotions. I actually had someone, one of our parishioners, I was having breakfast with her, and she said, you know, I had the funniest meeting with one of my bosses, who basically called me in and told me that I should lie, that I should be unethical, that I needed to do everything I possibly could for the betterment of the company, and that's all that really mattered. And I was kind of blown away, and yet he's really successful. So what am I supposed to think? That when you're trying hard to make your life come together and it's not quite working out, usually it creates bitterness, it creates resentment, and it also creates tremendous judgment. You know, where you look at other people and you say, they don't deserve what they're getting. I'm a better person than they are. I work harder than they do. I'm trying harder than they do. So why is this good stuff happening to them and not to me? And I know in my own heart, you know, judgment is a constant companion. I very much resonate with the older brother. I mean, I remember before my wife and I had kids, we used to see, you know, parents with their children in the park or on the airplane or in a restaurant, and we would say, we'll never be parents like that. Or our kids will never act that way. You know, our kids will never talk back to us the way they're talking back to those parents. And then you have kids. And what I've found is as soon as I say I will never do anything like that, I guarantee you that I will do something like that. And probably, you know, the less I think I'm capable of it, the more likely I am to do it immediately. This self-righteous and sort of goodness approach to life also doesn't work. It doesn't pan out. And on top of that, what we find is that being good or trying to be good often doesn't feel good because it's never enough. We can never be good enough. We can never get enough goodness for ourselves where we feel comfortable. And on top of that, it leads to loneliness because there's nothing less attractive than a judgmental, sort of self-righteous, goody-goody person. I remember there's a line in Dickens' Great Expectations where he's describing one particular female character, and he says she was good in the worst sense of the word. You know, and often the harder we're trying to be good, the more that that's true for us. And what we also find is that what I find in my life actually is that I'm a mixture of the two brothers. That there's times that I'm judgmental and self-righteous, and there's other times when I'm badly behaved. And I tend to be able to hold those things in tension. And I also tend to really be able to conveniently explain away all the bad stuff that I do, but be really harsh on other people. You know, like what I do behind closed doors is my own job, but or my own business, but I can't believe she spent that much money on a pair of shoes. Or, you know, my wife's favorite example is, you know, I feel completely entitled basically to watch as much sports as I want to. Not exactly, but that's pretty much true. You know, because sports are awesome, but how can you watch Gossip Girl? You know, because there's such a qualitative difference between those two. Not at all. So we find ourselves, you know, we find ourselves in a situation where we are trying to be happy, we're trying different approaches to find that happiness, and yet none of it seems to be working. So what's the solution? What does this story tell us about who God is? Well, what I would say is that what this story tells us is that transformation occurs when God's grace meets us at our point of need. If we look at the father figure in this story, what is most striking about him is that he shows his sons kindness after kindness after kindness after kindness. He gives the son the money and lets him go. He watches eagerly to see if the son's going to come back. He throws the robe on the son, and then even with the older son, when he comes in this sort of judgmental, harsh attitude, even then he says, son, I love you, and all that I have is yours. That he meets these sons with kindness after kindness after kindness. And I think, you know, we don't see it with the older son, but the prayer is that what would happen with both the sons, and that what would happen in our hearts as we encounter God's kindness and his grace in the midst of our bad behavior or our judgmental behavior, is that God's love for us actually is unconditional. It is unconditional. Because what the youngest son comes to see, and this is what some of us need to hear today, and what all of us need to hear at some point, is that there is nothing we can do, nothing we can do to lose God's love. that there is nothing we can do that puts us outside the realm of God's grace and mercy and forgiveness. But at the same time, what some of us need to hear today, and all of us need to hear at some point, is that similarly, there is nothing we can do to earn his love and his grace and his forgiveness. Nothing we can do to lose it. Nothing we can do to earn it. And the reason for that is because all of his love is based not on what we do, what we've done or what we might do, for good or for ill. It is all based on what Jesus has done for us on the cross. That the acceptance that we have comes from outside of us. That God looks at us and says, it is not according to your deeds that I will judge you. It is according to Jesus' deeds that I will judge you. Because he has died in your place for your sins. And he has earned the love that you could not. And there is nothing more that you need do. And this love, this grace, this unshakable favor, it both destroys our need to be bad. It destroys our need to run away and to rebel, because we see that a lot of times we rebel just to sort of get a rise out of the person that we're trying to rebel against. But God says, look, there's nothing you can do, so why don't you just give up on your rebellion? And at the same time, it causes us to give up our judgment and our self-righteousness and this constant need to earn, because it's just a free gift. And God says, here it is. And what it actually does for both the brothers and for us and for the conflicted parts of us that are trying to find happiness is it says, here's the space to just simply be. To be what you are and who you are in the midst of your conflicted sin and self-righteousness and judgment and bad behavior and good behavior. Here's a safe space to deal with that and for me to come and heal that. And that's really what this church is trying to be. It's trying to be a safe place that whether you're struggling with judgment or you're struggling with bad behavior or probably both at the same time, this is a place where Jesus says, neither do I condemn you. I do not condemn you, so come and be healed and receive the love that I have for you. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for the story. Thank you that your love is unconditional and it is unshakable and it is unbreakable. And in those places where we are trying to find happiness for ourselves through bad behavior or through good behavior, I pray that your love would break through, Lord, and give us the peace to just simply be and to rest in your tremendous grace towards us. Pray all these things in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen.